Looking to expand your horizons with books and podcasts? Check out Thoughts from a Page podcast with Cindy Burnett as she interviews authors and individuals in the publishing industry about books, new and old, as well as industry trends. ThoughtsFromAPage.com features everything you need, including recommended podcast episodes to get you started on your listening literary adventure with this excellent podcast. Check it out now, available on all major podcast streaming services, including Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Link in the show notes.
Hey everyone, this is Benjamin, aka The Terrible Aussie, and before we get to the latest episode of the podcast, we here at the Super Network would like to send a very special shout out to Paul C for being our latest subscriber on the Super Network Patreon. Thank you so much, Paul, for your support. It really means the world to both Marcy and I, and we deeply appreciate it, mate. Thank you so much. And now, on to the show.
The following is a Super Network production with Super Marcy.
Look, as much as I love that we don't really see images of that film, I just want to see that film.
The terrible Australian Bea Jemine.
If they made a romantic comedy out of The Fly, this would probably be it.
It contains coarse language.
After it was over and the credits were done, my friend just looked at me and he just said, "Dude, that was f***."
Mature themes.
Her husband wants her need satisfied, and she had a zombie baby with him.
Potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Please find us at supermarcy.com and subscribe to us via Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to episode 14 of Podcasters of Horror, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I do a retrospective series on specific anthology TV shows from horror director Mick Garris. And of course, with me as always is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy, how are you?
Hello. I'm doing well. How are you, Bead?
Oh, not too bad. Thanks, Marcy. Just looking forward to today's episode because this one is starting a new chapter in Podcasters of Horror because Masters of Horror is now behind us because we covered both seasons of the show. However, though, we, for the next couple of episodes, are going to be covering, I guess you could say, is the quote-unquote unofficial third season of Masters of Horror, which, of course, is the one season only anthology horror series that Mick Garris also created, which, of course, was Fear Itself. And so we'll definitely have a lot of discussions to talk about in terms of, like, this show, like, why did it only go for one season? Why is it most people consider it, like, the unofficial third season of Masters of Horror? So we definitely have a lot to discuss before we get into talking about the two first episodes of this show. But we are not alone, Marcy.
No, we are not. We are not. We are not fearing interfering itself alone.
Indeed. Indeed, and we have a very special guest who actually has appeared on a couple of episodes of Podcasters of Horror before, when we talked about a few episodes of specific episodes of Masters of Horror, and now he is back for this first episode of us covering Fear Itself, and that, of course, is the killer horror critic himself, Matt Konopka. Hello, Matt, how are you?
Hello, good to be here going through Fear Itself with both of you.
Indeed. But before we get to sort of like talking about the show overall, what is your, because we already know your relationship with Masters of Horror, hence why you've been on a few episodes with us in the past. But what is your relationship with Fear Itself as a whole?
Dated once, one night stand, it didn't really go anywhere. I was just realizing as I was prepping for this that I actually don't think I ever really watched a lot of Fear Itself for some reasons. I definitely recalled seeing the first episode, but I don't honestly think I've seen more than that.
and there's probably a good reason why that is.
Maybe.
we'll find out on this as we go over this season of Fear Itself. But I have not. until prepping for this, seen any of the episodes, so they are all first-time watches for me, and I don't remember why I never checked it out. I think just kind of didn't really hear much about it and forgot.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the thing. Like, I saw all the episodes, but the thing that's interesting about this show is, like, it sort of debuted in 2008. Only the first 8 episodes of the series actually went to air, but then the Olympics was on, so the show went into hiatus while the Olympics was on. But during that time, pretty much NBC, which, you know, showed this TV series, pretty much just quietly cancelled the show after that. And the remaining 5 episodes didn't get screened until, you know, the show was eventually released on DVD. Although some places in the world actually did show the final 5 episodes. But, yeah, it was kind of one of those shows that kind of it had a pretty decent amount of ratings when it came out, but it kind of just basically kind of went by the wayside after that. Because I think the reason for that is because, you know, most people will know that Masters of Horror only went for 2 seasons.
Yes.
And then Showtime decided not to continue with the show. So Mick Garris actually shopped the concept around to other places, and it was picked up by NBC. And instead of using the Masters of Horror title, they went with the title of Fear Itself. So that way it's the show basically is its own thing. But at the same time, though, like, it kind of still uses the same kind of concept as Masters of Horror, where they kind of feel like self-contained stories that have definitely have a sort of cinematic feel to them, but and also directed by well-known names in the horror genre. Like, that's kind of like the sort of the main thrust of it. But what's interesting, though, is now if you kind of notice watching the first episode, you'll see, like, it's created by Mick Garris, but it doesn't have him listed as an executive producer. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for why that is. So I've heard different rumors about, like, what happened with Fear Itself over the years. But luckily, I was, like, looking online. Mm-hmm. I found an interview that Mick Garris did last year for The Daily Dead, where one of the interviewer asked him about, like, what happened with both shows. And this is what he pretty much said. So it might be a bit of a long read, what I'm about to say, but I think it pretty much clarifies everything and gives, you know, context to our listeners, like, why did the show only went for 1 season and why it's sort of kind of forgotten about. So
I want your theatrical reading of this possible.
Yes.
Indeed. But here's what he said, and I'll just try to condense
it. Do your best, Mick Garris.
What does Mick Garris sound like again?
I'm very scared to do it because who knows? He could be listening to us right now and he might get offended by my impression.
Like, that motherfucker.
Exactly. But here's what he said. He said, the company that owned Anchor Bay, they financed the show, Masters of Horror, and had it licensed to Showtime. They had paid 10% of the production costs to do it, and the rest was international sales and TV and all that. So the company that owned Anchor Bay in its second season was bought by a company called Starz. After the second season, they decided they wanted to make more money immediately instead of letting the show grow and find its audience and following. As you probably know, these things take time, and you sell it around the world and wait for it to grow. So they sold it to Lionsgate. Showtime wanted to do a third season, but Lionsgate asked double for the license fee, and this virtually ended everything. They went, why? We want to pay twice as much, and they passed on the offer. Lionsgate started looking around for other places and a couple of places, and we got very close to an agreement, but in the end, it went to NBC, one of the 3 or 4 most important commercial networks in the States. A lot of advertising interruptions, many rules to follow. Not the ideal context to be able to do a kind of hard-hitting thing we wanted to do with the artistic freedom we had previously, all controlled by the directors. I wasn't interested, but I sat down with all the filmmakers, and many wanted to try. Let's give it a try. It worked with the Twilight Zone and the Outer Limits. Why not? So I found the title, which is Fear Itself. Clearly, we didn't want to call it Masters of Horror, being a different network. We went and developed 13 excellent scripts. Then we had the great writer's strike, and I left in solidarity, being a part of the union. The network asked me to stay on as producer, but I had no intention of giving advice and supervising the work of non-union screenwriters on how to change our scripts. They hired a bunch of non-union writers to run the show, Each script got worse, and all the reading of all the notes coming in from Lionsgate and NBC, and I realized then and there that these filmmakers were going to have, not going to have the creative freedom I had promised them. Each draft was worse than the previous one, and then the news came in that the episodes would be made in Edmonton, Canada, and not in Vancouver, where the most suitable structures are, and where we shot all the Masters of Horror episodes. My biggest fears were coming true. I made the decision to leave the project permanently. I didn't want to compromise what we had set out to do, and it was clear it wasn't becoming something I could be proud of, and I didn't want myself in a position to have to make excuses for it. So pretty much that's what happened. And basically after that, originally the first episode, which you're going to be talking about in a sec, was actually going to be directed by Mick Garris. But then, of course, once he left, another director came in. And not only that, a few directors who worked on Masters of Horror, like John Carpenter, Toby Hooper, and Joe Dante, they decided to not work on the series due to solidarity to Mick Garris. So that's pretty much the gist of what happened to Fear itself.
I think part of that touches on what maybe one of the largest issues was, which is the fact that they didn't have that freedom. You know, he's absolutely right. You go from Showtime with Masters of Horror, where you're giving directors, 90 minutes basically to do whatever they want. And we saw that with that series, directors were having complete creative freedom. I mean, they really could do whatever they wanted. There was no line you couldn't cross necessarily. And when you're doing a show for NBC, I mean, that's completely different. You know, you have to satisfy those advertisers. You are on network TV. You don't have the same kind of freedom. So, you can definitely sense that a bit in the series from what I've seen.
Yeah, well, that's just kind of the thing, I guess. And because with Fear itself, having seen all the episodes, you can definitely tell it felt like a very tame version of Masters. Like, even though, yeah, there was some violence and a bit of gore they were able to get away with, but at the time they couldn't get away as much with what they can on network television as they would on cable television network. And, of course, there was no nudity, no swearing, and also the episodes being a lot shorter, because with Masters, the episodes can be at least somewhere between 50 minutes to an hour long. But this, they had kind of shortened it down to about probably somewhere between 40 to 45 minutes, which made some of the episodes feel very rushed in comparison. So, so it doesn't surprise me at all, because I've heard about all this stuff that Mick Garris heard over the years, so it was good to kind of hear his side on what actually happened and explain why the series kind of turned out the way it did. But that being said, though, I think having seen all the episodes, there are some good little gems there. I think over the next couple of episodes, we'll definitely have a lot to discuss. And so I guess we'll get right to it and talk about the two very first episodes of Fear Itself. But first up, of course, is the pilot episode of the series, which is called The Sacrifice.
You must listen. Your brother was bitten. You have no choice but to kill him before he
kills. Kill my brother.
It is too late. He will become like the creature unless he dies by fire. A stake through the heart.
We chop off his head.
What are you saying? You're saying that thing is a vampire? You saying my brother is a vampire?
Not yet.
Which was directed by Breck Eisner, who after this film would go on to direct the remake of The Crazies and as well as direct The Last Witch Hunter. The episode was written by Mick Garris, which is based on a short story called The Lost Herd by Del Howenson. I probably butchered his name, so forgive me. And the episode stars Jeffrey Pierce, Jesse Plemons, and Rachel Miner, and a few others. And the plot summary for this episode is: four criminals take refuge inside an isolated snow-covered fort and encounter three sisters with a hidden secret who are harboring a monster. Now, Marcy, this is, again, you've never seen any episodes of yourself. Tell us your thoughts on the pilot episode, The Sacrifice.
Yeah, well, you know what? The first thing I noticed in, I guess, the opening kind of 5 minutes of this is that it really shows that production values went right down. It does look really cheap.
Yeah.
Whereas Masters of Horror, like, they didn't quite have the cinematic feel, but it at least looked like there was some money behind it to make this, you know, show what it was. This, it felt like it was made for like $5. It just looked that kind of cheap. And again, like even the music, the opening, it just felt so cheap. Like, why, you can have good music. Why does it sound so crap?
I do think it's funny that the opening credits for the series just feel so 2000s.
Yeah.
You know, you've got like that, like hard rock, punk, whatever kind of theme to it.
And the theme music.
Masters of Horror.
Yeah, and like the theme music was done by the lead singer of the band System of a Down. Or at least it was a song of his that was taken from his solo album they used as the opening theme.
Yeah,
that makes more sense to me.
Yeah, but I guess diving in, I was like, don't know what to expect. I noticed like this was, what, like 42-43 minutes or so. So I was like, okay, it's a bit shorter. There's definite feel, like, there's a definite pauses for ad breaks, so it does kind of break it up a bit, but it the story itself kind of does feel a little bit rushed, because you have no idea what the fuck is going on. But what I find interesting, and you kind of have said this as well, Bede, that a lot of actors who we know a lot more now, who were more unknown then, are in this series, and I'm like, watching this going, oh shit, it's like Jesse Plemons and there's Rachel Miner. Like, okay, I recognize some faces in this.
Oh, well, and we're going to see a lot more over the next couple of episodes, because there were tons of actors who kind of made their early starts in this series.
So, yeah. Overall, I thought this was kind of a mixed bag. Like, it was okay. It was watchable. The story itself is kind of interesting. It's got, like, this whole... you know, kind of like The Village, but if they were harboring vampires, kind of vibe to it. So I didn't mind that. It's just, I think, yeah, whatever they, you know, if they change the script with this, I don't know from what was originally written. But it moves okay. The acting is okay. Could have been better. You could tell the gore effects and stuff are just not what they were. Definitely not up to any scratch at all. And that is kind of toned down a fair bit. But, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a very mixed bag. I found it watchable, but, like, kind of almost, what's the point? What are you trying to say with this? Like, you didn't feel there was a message, whereas Masters of Horror, most episodes you felt like there was a message behind it. But, yeah. Matt, you can chime in. You're ready to.
No. Sorry. well, first I just want to say, for those that don't know, Del Howison, the writer of the short story that this is based on, for any of your listeners that either live in America or visit here, Del actually owns a shop here in Los Angeles called Dark Delicacies.
Oh.
Which is completely dedicated to horror, so he basically has like books, movies, and it's all, a lot of it's all signed stuff, horror memorabilia, posters, just a big supporter of the genre. And he has signings and stuff like that that go on there almost every other day or so throughout the month. So Del's a really cool guy. I've met him before. He's an older gentleman who's just super into the genre, and he writes himself, obviously. But just fun note there for anyone who ever visits Los Angeles, go seek out Dark Delicacies.
Well, I don't care about COVID right now. I want to visit this shop.
Yeah,
fuck everything.
Town, which is like a year-round Halloween shop. So
yeah, I need this in my life. I want to go there now.
Yeah, it's a pretty great corner of LA. But anyway, I will say I disagree slightly in the production value. I mean, it's obviously not up to the standards of Masters of Horror. I thought that the village setup was kind of cool, though. You know,
it looked cheap, but it still worked effectively as it could.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it looks like a ton of money was put into it, but it's a neat effect. Like I felt that they made it feel authentic enough, you know, just this little village that they have. And I like when they're first approaching it and the gate's all covered in, you know, antlers and a giant cross. Like, that's super unsettling. But in terms of the story, I mean, it's interesting because it's really basic on the surface. You know, I don't think that there's anything that is in there that's really, you know, rewriting the vampire lore or anything like that. Like, the story itself to me is fine. There's nothing that really stands out about it. Thematically, though, I think it's a little bit interesting because it sort of kind of plays like a modern play on Dracula and his brides. Because when you look at this, you know, our main characters in this village are the vampire and then the three women all dressed in white who are basically, you know, serving up his meals for him. And it sort of played like a modern take to me on that, because in traditional, you know, Dracula lore, usually the three brides are very subservient and enjoy being vampires. And, you know, there's not really a lot of messaging there with anything. But in this, it kind of felt like, you know, it kind of felt like a callback to time periods where women were kind of told to stay home, you know, and take care of the kids instead of going out in the world and working and stuff like that, which, you know, is all a bunch of bullshit. And in this, I felt like that kind of comes through, because here's these three women that are trapped in this village. They've never left it. You know, they've never seen the real world, and they've basically been forced to kind of spend their entire life serving this fucking, you know, dude vampire. And you can tell that all of them just want to get out of this life, but they can't, you know? So I thought those themes were kind of there. I don't know that any are so strong that they're very effective. But I got a little bit of that from it, so.
Well, you know, now that you say that, I'm like, I kind of pick up on that. Maybe I just wasn't engaged enough to pick up on that.
Yeah, it's kind of there. Like, and then you have to the fact that, you know, the people that are invading this village of theirs are these four men who are all pretty, you know, I mean, you got like the first guy who gets picked off is, you know, super horny and all that kind of stuff. Like, they're very typical, you know, maybe somewhat sexist men. And so it just kind of struck me as like, you know, here come these men that are basically fucking up their whole world all of a sudden, you know, now two of the girls die and you know, and they've been managing to keep this going their whole lives, and then these dudes show up and just messes everything up. So, and then you just, I don't know, you get a sense of, like, freedom from, I forget the name of the last girl, but the one who makes it, you just kind of get this sense of, like, she wins in the end, you know? Like, she's finally out, I guess. But yeah, again, I don't know that any of it's there enough to have the impact it's meant to, because I do kind of feel it was probably watered down quite a bit, so.
I can imagine it would have been. Bede, are you ready to chime in, young man?
Well, that's the thing. Having seen this episode, like, a second time now, like, I think it has an interesting setup, which is, like, this sort of, like, these group of criminals who sort of, their car breaks down, and deliberately so, because basically this little off community that's so isolated, alone, they basically, like, you know, basically cause car crashes to happen, and so whoever comes by there, they basically kidnap and feed to this vampire.
Why does, like, this sound familiar?
And it's like one of those things, like, this is a place where, like, this little community that has been, everyone who has lived there for years and years have been doing throughout. So this is like a sort of a chain of these three sisters and also their father, who's basically has kind of willingly allowed himself to be fed on by this vampire until better substance comes along. And also, like, the fact that this, I'm not sure how many years they've been doing this, probably 100 odd years or something like that. So this little community is basically almost wiped out except for these four people who, you know, of course, over the story, sort of one by one, they get killed off. Like, there's a lot of interesting ideas to it. But when you kind of sort of think about the sort of the plot of this story, a lot of it, there's a lot of logic gaps. Like, basically, they kill these people to make sure the vampire stays in, like, where in that fort. And so, you know, protect, and so they can protect the outside world. And I'm thinking to myself two things, like, number one, where is the vampire during the day? And number two, why doesn't the vampire just leave? It's not like that he's being held there against his will. And we've seen him a few times on top of, built on roofs, on the fort wall. Like, why doesn't he just piss off and leave?
Why doesn't he just piss off and leave?
There's a whole world out there for him to suck dry.
Exactly. And it's not like they're that far away from anything. All they do is, like, wait, the road's near where they are. They just wait for a car to stop by and get into a car and leave.
You know, see, what? That's a good point. And now this movie just makes no fucking sense.
See, they could have made... See, basically, this community of people who were holding this vampire in this area to keep, like, they were basically doing it for nothing. I mean, the vampire might have been... I mean, do they kill people every day? Does this vampire leave once a week, once a month?
How far out are they, you know? Like, how many cars are they getting per day?
Exactly. And also, when the car kind of, like, with the criminals, gets sort of breaks up, because the girls set up a trap for the car to break down, and it also have to be making sure they got a fire going on, because, like, their fort is so far away that you need at least some kind of smoke or something to show people, like, oh, there's a house way over there. And so they can go all the way there. But then I'm, like, thinking, it's like, if all three of those girls are there, who's the person with the shotgun just before the main credits of this episode?
Because the four girls?
No, there's three. But the thing is, though, we never see any of the other girls with shotguns. They only use, like, axes or other kind of, you know, kind of period weapons. So who is the person with the shotgun? I don't know.
I think you've thought of the logic of this too deeply.
I have thought of this logic. That's the thing, though. Like, I can definitely see, like, thematically what you both are saying, like, what this episode is going for, but I don't think it's as deep as any of that. Because it's like, this is just a stupid little community that's basically holding off this vampire who probably in his spare time is thinking to himself, like, hee, these idiots, they think I'm always around here. I'm just going to go piss off and eat a deer.
Right, he's like a whole state over for the rest of the week.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and this is, and I mean, if this vampire kills every single day, they would have been wiped out 100 years ago.
Well, you do really have to ask, like, okay, if they're, well, I guess they're not trapped there because of the vampire, right? Because they're feeding him to keep him there?
I don't know why!
Where is the vampire during this time? Like, during the day? I'm assuming he's, like, somewhere. Why not just kill him when he's asleep?
Well, apparently they can't.
See, this is what happens. Like, you got, like, they come over from, like, from
he's
another place in the world. A super vampire. They come up, so they just basically, because their logic is, like, you know, of, because they've never been out, like, these two, three girls and, you know, the people who also live there, they've never been outside these walls. They don't know about technology. I mean, I'm assuming they must be aware of certain things, because when they bring up, like, Jesse Plemons, like, brings up TVs and radios and stuff like that. Mm. Like, they do at least know what those are. See, this is the thing. Yeah. It's like, I'm just like thinking this episode really doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's an interesting idea, and it's cool to see Mick Garris going back to the vampire realm after, you know, the season two Masters Horror episode, the V word. But I don't think this episode quite makes sense, so it just really is a knock against it. But that being said, though, I think the first half is very rushed. And it just feels like it's just like being as rushed as it can, and the dialogue and some of the performances suffer. But once shit actually hits the fan, I do think it does at least become a bit more fun after that. Once the vampire, because I completely, even though I'd seen this episode, I completely forgot there was a vampire in this episode. So I was like, oh, there's a vampire in this episode. I completely forgot. Because I knew there was, like, there was this fort with these women, but I thought it was more sort of like they were kind of like these killers or something like that. It's like, oh, there's an actual vampire. I completely forgot about that. And it pretty much sums up everything about this episode.
Did you notice who was in this episode?
Yeah, Rachel Miner.
Everybody's favorite Australian blonde bogan.
Oh, was she really? Hold
on. Sophie Monk is in this episode.
Was she? Are you sure she was in this episode? Mm-hmm. I don't see her credited.
She is.
Is she?
She was Virginia.
Oh, that makes a lot of... Well, I did not know that. That makes a lot of sense.
It's really, it's unfortunate. I feel like this...
There were four. There were two Virginias.
Oh, what so the there's hell? Two... Oh, wait, there's two Virginia... Was she a body double? What's going on? Why is there two Virginias?
Yeah, it's been a body double then. I could swear there's only three girls.
It's like... because she kind of resembles... the other one that was Virginia.
Maybe they're like reshot scenes with Sophie Monk. Maybe
who knows? But she was definitely there because I'm like, that looks like her more than it looked like the other one.
The other actress wasn't available to do certain scenes. Let's just get Sophie Monk.
Apparently.
I was like, fuck you guys, I'm not coming back to set.
This film sucks. Peace.
It's unfortunate that I feel like they could have saved so many logic gaps if they would have just set it back in time in like the 1800s.
Yeah. You know?
Like set it back during Western times where it's like, okay, it makes sense. There's not another town for like, you know, 200 miles or whatever. So I don't know. Cause yeah, everything you're saying definitely put quite a few holes in it.
Or they could at least like say the vampire is chained up. And to make sure it doesn't go all, you know, like if it, when it gets hungry, it gets powerful or something like that to appease it, they feed it someone. So that way it kind of stays where it is and doesn't like go on a full killing spree. Like if it's locked up somewhere, you could easily see there's little things you could easily have fixed up on, like in that would have made it sense. And maybe this is what Mick Garris was talking about, like in the interview, because I know at another point in the interview, when he was asked about this episode, basically, like what he said was, and I'll quote this: he was asked, like, "I had written The Sacrifice. It was going to be directed by me. Breck Iser, who ended up shooting, did a good job visually.
He did do a good job.
I think visually the episode does look good, even though at first, like when it starts off, I'm thinking, it's very TV feel. But once it gets going, it gets better after that. Breck is a good director and tried to bring some of the elements of my original story, but the script had been completely rewritten and I don't like what they turned it into." So that was basically, the script was basically completely rewritten. So that's probably why nothing makes sense whatsoever.
Those goddamn non-human writers.
Exactly. Exactly.
How do I get the job?
Exactly. But I mean, I think for the most part, the acting isn't too bad. I think Rachel Miner and Jesse Plemons were probably the two best performances in the episode. Although I'm not sure why Jesse Plemons' character was named Lemon. Even though it does make...
I'm just not sure why they put such an emphasis on it. Like, my name's not really Lemon, it's Lemuel.
Yeah, what was that? Why?
I'm like, that's cool, man. Why do I care?
Exactly. Exactly. But, it's just like... It definitely doesn't... It's interesting, because at the time I think I saw this episode, I think I did enjoy it. But now rewatching it, I'm like speaking like... Yeah, this whole episode really does not make sense when you think about it. Like I said, the idea is cool, and you could do a lot with that idea. But, yeah, when you kind of think about a lot of, like, how it sort of all works, it really, there's way too many logic gaps for...
As you pointed out very successfully.
I mean, yeah, it's one I enjoy watching it, but it's definitely, once you start to pick it apart, it has quite a few flaws, for sure.
Indeed. But any final thoughts on this episode before we do our ratings? Marcy, you're...
Feels... Oh, go ahead.
Okay. I was going to... Oh, well, you go. You go.
Sorry.
Oh,
I was going to say, it feels like a pilot. It very much feels like a pilot, so...
Yeah, look, I think my final thoughts for this, it's a mixed bag. As we've said, there's some things that kind of work, a lot of things that don't really. It's strangely watchable. somehow. But yeah, I'd give it a solid whatever the fuck Jesse Plemons' name is. 2.5 of those out of 5.
2.5 lemons.
Yeah, I don't fucking
2.5 lemons. But Matt, your final thoughts and rating on The Sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, my final thoughts are like, look, it feels like a pilot. Pilots are typically pretty rough. It has a lot of logic issues that you just pointed out that I hadn't really focused
too much on. Exactly. He ruined it.
He ruined it for everyone, Bede.
Yes. Everyone's going to hate me now.
but I do think it's well directed. You know, I can't speak to what the script was like versus what they ended up with, but I think that Brecken Eisner did a fine job with it. You know, it's probably better directed than it should be. so I don't know. I give it, yeah, like a solid 2.5 or 3. It's fine. It's watchable. You know, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. I think I give it about 2.5 as well. And I think it's really as not good as the script is. And again, I'm blaming this all on rewrites rather than Mick Garris himself. I think the direction, like Brecken Eisner's direction, definitely is what makes at least the episode watchable. Because he does, at least once when shit actually hits the fan, it does become pretty entertaining and also quite intense in moments as well. And you can definitely see some of the elements that he would do for the Crazies remake that he would do next after this episode, because he kind of brings that kind of same intensity to a lot of the scares in that film. And yeah, just with a bigger budget. And and you know, some of the performances are kind of a mixed bag, but I think Rachel Miner being kind of, for me, kind of the strongest one. But it is kind of is kind of interesting seeing, like, yeah, Jesse Plemons, like, early Jesse Plemons, like, you know, 13 years, like, before, as he would grow as an actor and become, like, this big, well-known star. So, and now that I know that Sophie Monk, who may or may not have been in this episode, is kind of blowing my mind right now. I need confirmation. I might have to tweet her and find out of this for sure. But, we'll move right along to the second episode of Fear Itself, which, of course, is Spooked.
This is Dream, Dream, Dream.
Why are you so bad? I didn't deserve this, Harry.
I never hurt anybody who didn't deserve it.
That girl you burned?
You hurt me so bad.
She was innocent. Now all she knows is pain.
Look at all the scars.
That kid you kicked senseless.
You kicked him like 8 times.
He was just a witness.
Just what? I don't want to.
Why are you so bad?
I'm not so bad. I'm not so bad.
Why are you so bad?
Which was directed by Brad Anderson, who, of course, directed Session 9, The Machinist, and, of course, the Season 2 episode of Masters of Horror, Sounds Like. And the episode was written by Matt Venn, who has quite an interesting writing career. he wrote, of course, the Season 2 episode of Masters of Horror, Pelts, which...
Oh, yes, we loved Pelts.
And also his film, like, his film scripts that he's written include... Mirrors 2, Fright Night 2, White Noise 2, The Light, and The Exorcism of Molly Hartley. Although he did recently write an episode of Creep Show as well. So he's definitely got a lot of horror. And this episode, the plot for this one is... During a stakeout, a private investigator comes face to face with the demons of his past. And I forgot to say who this episode stars. It stars, of course, the one, the only, Eric Roberts, along with Cynthia Watros, Larry Gillard Jr., and Jack Noseworthy as well.
Yes. I didn't get super excited that Eric Roberts was in an episode, like, at all.
Indeed. But, Marcy, again, since this is your first time watching the episode, what did you think of Spooked?
I thought this was a much better episode, actually. This one was actually really kind of creepy and unsettling, and I really liked that. But I think that's kind of what Brett Anderson as a director is really good at. Things that are very unsettling and mysterious and uncomfortable. Like, this is a bit of a mystery kind of story as you're following the PI played by Eric Roberts, and there's a lot of shit going down. There's a lot of creepy stuff happening. You don't know if you should be trusting Cynthia Waltrose as well. But I'm kind of babbling. But this one actually went into some very interesting, like, plot directions that I actually was not expecting. So that's always a surprise for me. If I wasn't expecting it, it had one of those kind of messes with your head a bit, ending and revelation. But overall, I actually quite enjoyed this one. It was, yeah, definitely a step up. But, you know, that could be perhaps... maybe the script just worked, or maybe the actors and director just made this one work. Maybe it was just the fact that it had Eric Roberts being all Eric Roberts-y. But that was kind of beautiful. Mwah, Eric Roberts. And it was kind of funny as I'm watching it. I've got Graham going, is that doctor guy? And I knew exactly what he meant, because he was made to watch Stalked by My Doctor and he recognized Eric Roberts. So there you go. Matt, enlighten us on Spooked.
Indeed.
Oh, I don't know how enlightening it's gonna be, but yeah, no, I completely agree 100%. I thought this was a much better episode than Sacrifice. Really, for just because of the excellence all around, actually. You know, I think, yeah, Anderson's an incredible director. I mean, if you've ever seen Session 9, that's one of the creepiest fucking movies of the last 15 years, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that, I watched that recently, and that movie still gives me chills.
I want to rewatch it so bad after watching this now.
It's so, so good. But yeah, no, he's really effective at creating a good spooky atmosphere. The script works, you know? I haven't really been impressed with a lot of the writer's other work, but this is, I think that this is very effective. You know, the thematics are very strong. The performances are very strong. Like, you actually, you know, when you get to the latter half of this episode and you really start to feel Eric Roberts' character's emotions coming out in this, like, he really sells that performance.
He
like,
does.
You really feel his pain in this.
Oh, yeah. And, anytime you see an actor legit, like, frothing at the mouth, legit spitting every time they cry, you know they are 110% committed to that performance.
Yeah, and it just works so well, you know, because, again, like, the thematics on this are just really strong. I mean, you have that moment early on in the episode where Eric Roberts says something like, sometimes you got to do a wrong to make things right, you know, after he's murdered somebody. And it's just, it's so kind of devastating when you find out later on that he got that from his dad after accidentally murdering his brother, you know, with the gun. And you just kind of realize that he's never had an issue with all the families that he has been destroying through his career, because in his mind, it's acceptable to do, because doing something like that makes something else right. You know, he has a twisted logic of it. And so to see him confronted with that in the end, it's just it's devastating. Like, it's a really well made episode. I really enjoyed it.
And I kind of forgot to add, but this is very much like, be, if you need to own a gun or guns, be fucking responsible, because this is the shit that'll happen. And you know what? I'm totally down with that message.
Yeah, no, it's a great message. I mean, I went through that a lot as a kid, because my entire family except me owns guns. So
wow,
that was a heavy theme of our household. But yeah, and they do really interesting things with that too, because you have like the nightmare sort of where he imagines his dad pulling out all of his teeth and putting in bullets, which I thought was
that was fucked. That was
fucked up, you know, and to me, that's just like the perfect imagery for guns, in a sense of just like, it, you know, taking those bullets and making it terrifying. You know, I mean, because we, especially here in America, we get too used to the image of guns. And, you know, they're just like part of everyday life, practically. And so I appreciate something like this that's like, no, guns are fucking terrifying and we need to acknowledge that.
Yep.
Oh, definitely. Rewatching this episode again for the show, like, I will say it's kind of is minor Brad Anderson in terms of his filmography, but it's still a pretty solid episode. I think he sort of, again, this is another case where I think the script itself was pretty decent, but I think Anderson himself, along with Eric Roberts's performance, kind of elevate the material. And being that this is kind of more psychological horror, this is definitely without a doubt in Brad Anderson's wheelhouse for sure, because he's a master of doing psychological horror. And also, it's interesting because in a way you could see this as a companion piece to Sounds Like, which also was centered around a character hearing stuff. So this is with, instead in this one, it's a private investigator who decides to hide out in this house, which happens to be haunted, and sort of spying on a house which may be the that Cynthia Watros owns with her and her husband, and trying to find out if he's been cheating on her or not. But of course, then you find out as the story progresses, not everything is what it seems. But what I think is interesting about this episode is there's a lot of complexity with the characters. Like, these are characters that, like, as in another film, like, character like Eric Roberts's character, like, who kind of uses sort of police brutality to in, like, when he's when he handles witnesses. And as we find out, like, a lot of the people he's, like, done that to have been innocent of things. But then the movie kind of shows us, like, shows Jack Noseworthy's character. We see him kind of do that. And we find out that Jack Noseworthy actually did kidnap a kid. But then, of course, like, his spirit comes back and basically wants revenge against Eric Roberts. So the episode's interesting because it treats both Eric's character and Jack Noseworthy's character a bit more complicated and complex because in a normal situation, like, Eric Roberts being this police officer who uses brutality would be the villain. And, of course, Jack Noseworthy's character would be, like, the innocent one. But the fact that they're both flawed characters who have done equally horrible things on their own, having them go up against each other, it really makes it a much more interesting episode because you're not sure who you're really siding with in this episode. Because it shows both sides. But I guess, like, I guess to quote Homer Simpson, in the episode where he's basically voting for Sideshow, whether he should not vote for Sideshow Bob, I'm thinking, like, I don't agree with Eric Roberts' character using police brutality, but in case of Jack Noseworthy kidnapping a kid, maybe it's kind of necessary. I don't know, because that's the complicated thing, because it makes you think about this stuff. Like, what would you do in situations like that? And I think that's one of the things that I think is interesting about the episode, and is because it shows these type of things are more gray than black and white. And I think, and it kind of makes you question these things. And also, but I think the most important thing, like you said, Marcy, is that this episode does have an anti-gun kind of message to it as well. It's like, if you have a gun, be absolutely responsible for it. Don't just put it up in a wardrobe where your kids can easily get at it. Exactly. And also, like, even Cynthia Watrous's character, who's this poor woman who is feeling the loss of her brother, gets in a pact with three other people to kind of bring his spirit back, but then something goes wrong. And the other three had to kill themselves, and then she had to kill herself. She survived. So to basically, to, like, honor that, she gets Eric Roberts to be in her place. So... And at the same thing, you see at the same time, it's like, even though, yes, she's consumed with grief, but she's also, this woman in a way kind of is in denial of what her brother also did as well. Because he's not entirely innocent either. I mean, he kidnapped a kid. Who knows what he had done or was going to do to that boy. So it's an interesting episode. And the more I think about it, the more I think there's a lot of interesting layers to this episode that makes it an interesting one to discuss.
Yes.
No, I think you hit exactly why it's so effective. You know, it is complicated. You know, it is emotionally challenging, and it's why I like something like this compared to, you know, Sacrifice, which is very simplistic. You know, Sacrifice is very much kind of good versus evil. And those stories tend to bore me a little bit compared to something like this, because I like the challenge that you're talking about of, you know, how much on the side of Eric Roberts' character can you be, you know, because you're absolutely right. Like, it's tough. It's a difficult decision, because do you agree with, you know, like, if you were in that position, would you do the same to someone who was going to hurt a child, or would you not, you know? And it's, I think it's questions like that that make it more terrifying, because, you know, I think that us as viewers, it's harder to relate sometimes to characters that are either pure evil or pure good, because they don't, that's not realistic, you know? Yeah. All of us is gray, and none of us are perfect, and hopefully none of us are pure evil, you know? So, except maybe you, Marcy, maybe you're
perfect. I'm perfect and evil.
I'm just terrible. What can I say?
Right.
I'm probably more terrible than Eric Roberts and Jack Dosworthy in this episode.
but life is all great, you know. And I think it's very challenging for viewers when we're put in that place of having to kind of figure out what would we do. And that's the terrifying part, is when you don't know the answer to that. You know, like, you can look at what Eric Roberts is doing and you're like, I don't know what I would do. And that scares you, you know, because you're like, I don't want to be the guy doing the police brutality, but I also don't want to be the coward that doesn't, you know, maybe do the right thing. So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with just about everything that you guys have said. Like, this is a showcase of, like, you know, the way people are with the shades of gray. Like, it's a case where you don't necessarily have a clear kind of protagonist or antagonist, because you could consider that to be any one of them. And doesn't really apologize for how these people are either. And basically, like, confronting, like, how he confronts his own past and stuff is, like, really full on. Like, Eric Roberts went all in for this fucking role, and good on him for doing so. But yeah, like, the kind of way it wraps up with this ending, it's like that gun message ending. Like, this dude, he comments earlier on, like, why do you have the gun? I don't want anyone here to have a gun. And then he just goes against it and ends up shooting him. So yeah, but I thought this was definitely a massive step up, from The Sacrifice, but I guess it remains to be seen if other episodes will be this good, or, you know, what the quality will be like. But this one definitely I'd recommend people to actually watch for sure. It's pretty good.
Oh, definitely. Like, I think it's at least, even though we're only two episodes into this discussion on Fear itself, I think this one could work as a feature-length one. You could make this story a little bit longer if you wanted to, maybe not 2 hours long, but maybe 90 minutes or something like that. So that way you can sort of further more develop the characters and also kind of give it more of that sort of, like, even though there's a lot of sort of creepy moments in it and that Brad Anderson does a good job with, like, it's definitely a bit more faster paced than his usual kind of horror films, except for maybe The Call, because that's probably the most fast-paced horror film he's ever done. But in terms of, like, if it had a bit more of a leisurely pace, it would definitely be feel even more so like a Brad Anderson film. So this is what I could definitely see that would even just benefit just as much as a feature-length film.
Yeah, I can see that, if he was kind of, you know, engage more in the atmosphere of it, give us more of those nightmares, that kind of stuff. I can definitely see him drawing out the
fears. Definitely. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for Spoot.
So I think it's pretty solid, a very good follow-up episode. I have a feeling it'll probably be one of the better episodes of the show, but I guess we'll see what happens. But yeah, I give this movie 3 out of 5 crazy Cynthia Waltrose, hoping Eric Roberts gets shot, out of 5.
And Matt, what are your final thoughts and rating for Spooked?
Yeah, I think it's a great episode. It's very effective. You know, like I said, I really felt the pain of all those characters in the end of this. I mean, the performances were incredible. So I think considering that, with how well directed it is, and that it is TV and not working with, you know, the budget of a feature film, I'd probably give it a 3.5 bullet teeth out of 5.
All right, I will give it about 3.5 as well. 3.5 creepy pictures of people up on the wall out of 5. Those pictures were creepy.
That was very effective shit. That was effective shots.
Not
man.
Even just the pictures, but actually showing the pictures, like slitting their throats. And that's fucking, that was some weird shit.
That was weird fucking shit. All right. All right.
Although not as creepy as like Cynthia Waltrose's creepy laugh at the very end of this episode.
Oh, she was fucking like ready to bloody orgasm her pants after he died.
I mean, yeah, again, that's one of the really fucking creepy parts of this episode. You know, she's kind of right, but also, hey, you're kind of psychotic.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And now she's going to go kidnap kids herself. Maybe. I don't know. That's my headcanon. That's my headcanon in this episode.
Yeah, right.
But, I guess that will be a wrap on this first episode, diving into Fear Itself. I hope all our listeners enjoyed our discussions on this episode. And we definitely have quite a number of episodes, like, over the next... I think adding how many episodes in particular, I think we're doing 7 on Fear Itself. So this is the first, and we'll have 6 more every month after that. So we'll definitely have a lot of interesting things to talk about. And Matt, you're always more than welcome to come back and discuss any of these episodes if there's any in particular that tickles your fancy.
Yes.
Hell yeah.
Damn straight. And, we'll wrap up the show. And, Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week?
Well, you can always find us at our base of operations, the Super Network, at supermarcy.com. You can always find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesupernetwork. You can join the Facebook group, which is under the Super Network group on Facebook, where we have polls and discussions and memes and all sorts of crazy things there. You can follow me personally on Twitter if you so desire to do so, at twitter.com/supermarcy. You can also follow the Super Network on Twitter at twitter.com/sm_supernetwork. We're also on YouTube. You can look for us under the Super Network YouTube channel, or look up either Super Marcy or Bead. I'm sure you'll find us on there. And we are on Instagram, which is the.super.network, and on TikTok at the Super Network. And of course, you can find all of our podcasts, Podcasters of Horror, the Super Podcast, all of them, on all your major podcast streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, all of the good ones. And of course, please remember to leave us a rating or review if it has that function, because it helps us a lot. And then we know that you love us and we'll be happy. Bead, where can people find you, bitch?
If people want to find me personally, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeeJamine, or my personal writer's page on Facebook at facebook.com/TerribleAussie. And, of course, you can always find all my writings over at supermarcy.com with reviews and columns. And now, Matt, where can people find you on the internet this week?
So you can find me on Twitter at KillerCritics. I never really use Facebook or Instagram or anything else, so don't bother following me there.
How dare you?
You can also find all of my writings on killerhorrorcritic.com. Mostly I do reviews because I'm working on other things right now, but occasionally I'll, you know, write something interesting, I guess. But and then you can also follow my podcast, Killer Horror Critic, that I do with my wife, where we basically have a theme each month, and we'll go through different movies that fit that theme and analyze them drunk and, you know, usually come up with somewhat weird themes and ideas, I guess, sometimes.
Well, maybe Marcy will have to, like, suggest some fave ideas for you.
We'll just be sitting there like, invite us as a guest just once, please.
I will have to do that at some point, and I also have to put up a post asking for themes. I keep meaning to do that.
I know that at the moment you're doing Shark Month, so yes. I'll be curious. At least by the time this episode is online, it'll probably already be wrapping up. But I look forward to seeing what you do for the next episode. And I was found your episode on Bait to be a very interesting and podcast on that on that movie.
Oh, thank you. Bait was fun to talk about. I did not expect to be comparing it to Noah's Ark, but, you know, there it works.
Bait is a classic, and I'm sad I didn't get to talk about it on your show.
I'm sorry.
I am still laughing at I think it was the burning where you're talking about, like, how much you love the killer in that movie.
Uh-huh.
And I think Chris was like, no, and then you just making fun of each other. I was just laughing my head off. It was so funny.
Yeah, that's basically our relationship in a nutshell, is just making fun of each other and yelling at each other. It's actually not that, so.
It's like me and Marcy as well. We just make fun of each other all the time.
More so me than you, but whatever.
Well, that is true.
I'm just a bitch. We all know that.
But, I guess that'll be a wrap on this episode of Podcasters of Horror. Look out for the next episode in August, but September? It is
what month
September.
Is it?
Yeah, well, it is August, at least when this episode airs, so September. So keep a lookout for that one, and we'll see you all then. See you, everybody. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark doo 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 doo. Surfy shark doo 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 doo.
And now back to the show.